Saturday, the NCAA men's basketball Final Four will face off, starting with number 3 seed University of Michigan and 11th seed Loyola Chicago. Some are praying for the Loyola Ramblers. In fact, they have their own nun, Sister Jean, who's now the best-selling bobblehead of all time, and her Ramblers are the Cinderellas of March Madness. Why do Americans love underdogs so much? Let's get the backstory from Ed Ayers. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
And Brian Ballow. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Robin.
Historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Let's get the backstory on this. Ed, start with you. The underdog, a theme since when?
Well, I think ever since 13 scrappy colonies went up against the largest empire in the modern world. The beauty of America is everybody can think of themselves as an underdog in some way. You know, the only true ones were the indigenous people who had home court advantage but still ended up really suffering from all that. I think that, you know, it does seem to be something that's hardwired into the American psyche to somehow cheer for people who seem as if they are up against the odds.
Yeah, and Ed, I'm wondering, that sense of, you know, somebody's up against the odds, so there's almost a sense of what, wanting a fairness?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what the country is really about. The American dream is everybody has a chance. And if you find that the underdogs don't have a chance, it kind of pokes holes in that dream.
Well, Brian, where do the actual words come from? You know, dark horse, underdog.
Well, dark horse comes from horse racing, and it didn't refer to the color, but it does refer to a lack of information about the horse. So you knew you were taking a bigger chance if you bet on that dark horse. And I think that sums up pretty well a whole range of what we call underdogs, whether they're presidential candidates, we're kind of not so sure we know about this guy, or whether it's figures in popular culture.
Well, talk about the not sure we know this guy. Some people might be surprised if they don't remember, you know, social studies. One of those dark horses was Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to turn that over to our Lincoln Prize winner, Ed Ayers.
Okay, well, we defer, Ed Ayers, with your two Lincoln Prizes. But remind us, we think, of course, now he's, you know,
He's Abraham Lincoln.
He's Abraham Lincoln,
right?
Yeah. But tell us when he was a dark horse.
Well, his whole life until he was elected president of the United States in many ways. I was just visiting the Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois, and very interesting to see how it's presented. You walk into the museum and you take the left and you're going into the log cabin, and there's a three-dimensional life-size model of Abraham Lincoln reading by the fire while everybody else in his family is asleep, right? And then you kind of have to go through that world of when he works in a store and you see his pant legs are too short and his shirt sleeves are too short. As much space is spent on representing Abraham Lincoln as an underdog as is spent on portraying him as the most powerful person in the United States.
I love the fact that you guys that were, you know, talking about Abraham Lincoln as the underdog, the dark horse, in the same segment that was prompted by Loyola.
It is Illinois, Robin.
Right. I love that. But do you think that this is something of the past? Because now we have, well, I guess we do have underdogs. I mean, Donald Trump was considered an underdog, and yet he doesn't have poor beginnings.
Absolutely. We have people like Harry S. Truman, really came from a pretty impoverished background, was pretty unsuccessful himself in his business endeavors, and absolutely was not expected to win in the election of 1948. In fact, the most iconic photograph of Harry S. Truman is him holding up the newspaper saying that his opponent, Dewey, wins the election, which of course he didn't. Truman won. On the other hand, we have people like Donald Trump, who has styled himself as an underdog. I mean, in fact, Donald Trump came from quite a wealthy background, but he's somebody who feels no matter what kind of advantage he has in politics, the whole system is rigged against him. I don't think you can understand Donald Trump unless you understand that the vast majority of people who voted for Clinton came from counties where the economy is contributing a disproportionate amount to the GDP. And those who voted for Trump came from counties where they live is underrepresented in America's economy. They are literally underdogs. They feel underrepresented.
But Ed, back to sports. Give us another example of, I mean, there's so many, but underdogs.
Well, the Olympics are great because somehow we can be the most powerful nation in the world and still feel like we're not really respected as we should be in one sport or another. I think we look back on, you know, the underdog of Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics against Hitler. And not only is America winning, but the people who are perpetual underdogs in America overcome these obstacles to win. And then you go all the way up into, you know, the Miracle on Ice, in which a ragtag team of American hockey players beat the powerful Red Machine of the Soviet Union. And we've played lots of games over the years, but interesting how we transpose this sports underdogness in some ways to geopolitical standing as well.
I'm just wondering, we are embracing this as an American tradition and way of thinking. Don't other countries also root for the underdog?
I do think it's human nature to root for underdogs, but I would argue there is something in American history, probably pretty connected to not having an aristocracy or a ruling class, as you were talking about earlier, that makes us feel that, you know, we all come from an even playing field and the best man or woman should win the race.
Okay, so bring us back to this year's March Madness. What's your sense of this whole season?
You know, being a historian, I want to talk about Loyola Chicago in a little more historical depth. I don't know if people remember, but they've been here before, and they were even larger underdogs because they had the audacity, if you can imagine this, to put four African-American players on the floor at the same time when there was a kind of unspoken agreement that a team would play no more than three at a time. And then in the early 1960s, they win the national championship with four African-American players. Mm. And it's interesting that we now just think of them as being from a small conference or a small school or whatever, or we think about Sister Jean. But you could also see them as sort of a vehicle by which college basketball and American sports kind of integrated itself.
And Ed always ends on an uplifting note. I'm going to point out a somewhat depressing note. I think the exception to Americans always rooting for the underdog is that has not been the case when it has come to a majority of Americans rooting for African Americans. I think quite often we found white Americans rooting for white athletes to beat African American athletes in whatever sport it was internally. Now, Ed's right. When America goes to the Olympics and we're fighting against the Nazis or the competing against the Nazis, we can get behind Jesse Owens. But whether it's Jackie Robinson making his way up through the major leagues or any of the heroic stories of African Americans against the odds, people were not rooting for the underdog, meaning the majority of American people. Mm.
It is our flaw. I want to mention one other team that was underdog, and as you were saying, Ed, it's just a team that was the huge underdog, and it won, it went pretty far, but then people realized, oh, not only was it great athletically, but it's a great school academically, far beyond the expectations for it, and that was the Maryland-Baltimore County, UMBC?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm in the world of higher education, and I've been a big fan of UMBC for a long time. Freeman Hrabowski, their president, has really set the standard for the whole country in producing African-American PhDs. And so that's, you know, the dream that all of us have who are in higher education. There's going to be some moment when they turn away from the game and say something about the university. And I think that's another thing that makes this resonate so much for Americans. You're not just pulling for a professional team. These are places that are located somewhere that are pulling players from a place with a particular identity. And I think it helps a lot when you're playing against places that have so-called blue blood. Now, that's an interesting phrase that people use in the sports pages, to talk about a sports team as if it's an aristocrat blue blood, which I think only turns up the underdog motif on people who are not blue bloods.
Bringing us with the aristocrats and the blue bloods back to the origins of the country and the overthrowing of the aristocrats. That's Ed Ayers. We've also been speaking with Brian Ballow, historians, co-host of the weekly podcast Backstory. Ed, Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. The cry goes up both far and near.